I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, were we lied to, were we manipulated concerning the end or eradication of polio? This is one of the superstars of the vaccine world. First, it was the smallpox vaccine overcoming smallpox, then the polio overcoming polio, then measles vaccine overcoming measles. What if all three of these did not eradicate the diseases, were not the primary reason for their diminishment as major causes of death? Today, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, who holds two board certifications in medical sciences, is going to give us an in-depth, really interesting look at polio and some other vaccine issues. At the very least, she has spent thousands upon thousands of hours engaged in real research, looking for the truth, and we benefit from that here. This will allow us, in turn, to be better informed, so we will have a better way of looking at our freedom of choice to vaccinate or not to. Now to Dr. Humphreys.
Well, I'd like to start by giving you a little background and tell you how and why I'm here talking about polio and vaccination today. In 2009, I personally witnessed several patients develop complete kidney failure in their normal kidneys or worsening of their underlying kidney problems after they were vaccinated. This was unsettling to me. I became more vigilant and started taking vaccine histories on all my patients. And I started to notice that there was more influence on kidneys and overall health than I previously recognized. I was never a big fan of vaccination, and I tried to skip them whenever I could for myself. I was terribly ill after a flu vaccine during medical school, and as an adult nephrologist, the pediatric schedule was just never in my radar, and most of the vaccinations that go on with kidney patients are all protocoled, so I just really never paid much attention to it, honestly, so I needed a wake-up call. But what happened is that there was something new going on in the field of medicine in 2009, and that was that vaccinating very ill patients had not only become accepted among medical practitioners, but it had become systematically built into hospital protocol. I admitted a patient that had a severe inflammatory nephropathy, and when I got up to the floor to see her, there was already an order in the chart and a flu vaccine was given to her before I even talked to her. Well, I was lit about that. I started to notice that cancer patients, congestive heart failure patients, heart attack, sepsis, kidney failure patients were all getting flu and pneumonia shots, often on their first days of hospitalization, and many while they were acutely ill, receiving chemotherapy or having acute active kidney failure. I had a patient with Guillain-Barré syndrome getting plasmapheresis, and they insisted on giving him a flu vaccine. And even more unbelievable is that people were being vaccinated even before a diagnosis had been made. I asked the hospital administration to wait until discharge day to vaccinate these very sick people. I knew they wouldn't stop doing it altogether. I was later informed that they discussed my concerns at a meeting and that the policy would remain as is. My conflict with the hospital administration persisted until I ultimately resigned. But in the meantime, in my discussion with other doctors, I was prompted to look into the practice of vaccination further. And I wanted to see what studies had been done to analyze the impact on seriously acutely ill patients getting vaccinated, and I found that there were absolutely no studies whatsoever. The deeper I looked into it, the more shocked I became, and I found that the vaccine business was fraught with dishonesty and misinformation. And this goes back since the smallpox vaccine, by the way. Most conventional medical doctors are convinced the vaccines are useful. But if they were to look at the proper statistics and study the incidence of those diseases, questions about what they are told should immediately come to their minds. But amazingly, the majority don't question even when they're prompted. I left my conventional medical position in 2011, and most of what I do now is read and write on the topic of vaccination. Like the smallpox vaccine, the medical system's endorsement of their in-house history of the polio vaccines is always presented to the public and to students of the medical system in terms of heroism. Jonas Salk's heroism. Society's acceptance of this history is used to validate and underpin the mandating of hepatitis B vaccine to infants only hours old, chickenpox vaccines for school children, to annual flu vaccines for everybody starting at 6 months of age until death, to human papillomavirus vaccines to preteens, adolescents, and older people, and all in the name of supposedly healthier people. As with smallpox and polio vaccines, suggestion of harm caused by any vaccine today is mostly rejected as being coincidental, with any harm solely temporally related. When I had my patient show up with kidney failure after having influenza vaccines, and I talked to the administration about it, he insisted that the patients just got influenza before that vaccine could take effect. My opinion as a nephrologist and what I saw in the kidneys meant nothing. And this had never happened to me before. Anytime I said to stop a drug because it was affecting the kidneys in the past, the drug was stopped. But all of a sudden, there was just some protective veil around vaccination that really woke me up. Well, the question that arises is, what do the official documents and ignored medical literature reveal about the polio vaccine, which the endorsed history doesn't? In my search for answers to sound bites like, smallpox was eradicated by vaccines, and polio was eradicated in the Western Hemisphere because of vaccines, which is what I was told when I would complain about the flu vaccine and the pneumonia vaccine today, I had to answer not only the questions that were coming at me from other doctors, but then my own questions, because I had been taught everything all wrong. What you'll hear today is a tiny proportion of a mass of information that I found, which led me to question the belief that polio disappeared thanks to a vaccine. I've attempted to distill a century of the history on polio into a one-hour talk. It's actually 1 hour and 20 minutes. This is virtually impossible. I've had to leave out some very interesting and important events. But if you want to learn more about it, I wrote a book on the history of vaccination that covers the smallpox era, the polio era, as well as several other of the mandatory vaccines for children, and why I think that events other than vaccination led humanity out of the era of the huge mortality from infectious diseases that we've become so familiar with. When I say humanity, I'm being limited. Europe, United States, UK, that's where most of the data was generated back when there was the huge mortality rate. Now this is going on over in Africa and India and Afghanistan, and they're seeing the same thing that we saw back then. Okay, now I get to figure out how to work this thing. Okay. I want to talk about a little bit about science and the limited vista that scientists have upon reality, because science is often thrown back at me, especially by people that are enthusiastic about vaccines, that they're so scientific. So I want to just say that science is defined as systematic knowledge of the physical and material world that's gained through observation and experimentation. But scientific discoveries often only reveal a very narrow window into greater realities, or lead to shallow understandings of deeper truths. Certainly the word science isn't synonymous with established accurate fact. We see science advancing and changing its perceptions all the time, don't we? We see the rules change in medicine, we see the recommendations by the AMA and all these other organizations change. But the thing is that the truth doesn't change. What changes is how scientists see the truth, and that will never be a full picture. With polio, scientists exploited one singular discovery, and that was the association of a particle termed a virus that could be found in the nerves of some corpses that succumbed to paralysis. With that one discovery, an entire single-minded campaign was launched in order to develop a vaccine to give to every child in the world numerous times. Any scientist who disagreed with the flow of information, as it was directed by the bottleneck to grant money through the National Foundation of Infantile Paralysis in the 1930s through 1950s, was either fired or lost their funding. Years later, in 2004, Dr. Paul Meyer, who was one of the inventors of the Myers-Briggs test, a very famous statistician, commented to this and testified to this fact in an interview because he had been there as a firsthand witness. This here is a pie chart that I made up to show the Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimation of morbidity and mortality after infection with polio virus. Okay? They say that approximately 95% of persons infected with poliovirus will have no symptoms. About 4 to 8% of infected persons have minor symptoms such as fever, fatigue, nausea, headache, flu-like symptoms, stiffness of the neck and back, and pain in the limbs, which often resolve completely. And that represents this yellow portion right here. I think probably everybody in this room has had that syndrome, haven't we? Fewer than 1% of polio cases result in permanent paralysis of the limbs, usually the legs, and of those paralyzed, 5 to 10% die when the paralysis strikes the respiratory muscles. And that's represented by this red sliver right there. Well, I want to ask you now, what other vaccine-targeted illness do you know of that's asymptomatic in 95 to 98% of people infected? And does it make any sense to vaccinate every child on the planet? Because they didn't understand what was going on here in that 1% of people. The question that's never been answered properly is what really caused a small proportion of problems with a virus that was asymptomatic in 95 to 98% of people infected. So in order to understand where polio went, we have to understand what polio was. And we have to understand what added circumstances were involved in the paralysis that was known as polio. I just want to start with a definition here. You probably have heard several terms to describe polio, such as paralysis, palsy, apoplexy, poliomyelitis, and infantile paralysis. But of those, only poliomyelitis is a technical term, and it just means inflammation of the gray matter of the spinal cord. The gray matter is this butterfly part in the middle, and the anterior horn is labeled right here. The anterior horn of the spinal cord is involved in poliomyelitis. That's the part that harbors motor neurons that innervate the muscles of the face, the neck, the trunk, and the limbs. Well, poliomyelitis became shortened to the word polio and was widely thought of as caused by a particular virus termed a poliovirus, which is an enterovirus. An enterovirus infects the gastrointestinal system. These viruses are swallowed, and they go into the mucosa, and then they eventually end up in the lymph nodes where they're processed by the immune system, and at some point they can become bloodborne. And the theory is that when things go wrong and immunity doesn't happen, when there's not normal cell-mediated immunity or antibody-mediated immunity in the innate immunity system, that virus can end up in the central nervous system, and that's when problems can occur. And that's the theory. Well, before the use of the vaccine, the term poliomyelitis described a variety of clinical pathological entities, which could all look the same. This was a problematic issue, and it was only addressed from 1955 afterwards, after the vaccine was deployed. There was a very successful public health campaign that was initiated by Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his law partner, Basil O'Connor. At some point, the Rockefeller Institute became involved with the new organization called the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. That later gave birth to the March of Dimes, which we're all familiar with because they're still collecting money today to vaccinate pregnant women and infants all over the world. Well, Dr. John Pohl was one of the enlightened doctors at the time, and he was head of a polio treatment center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And he reflected upon polio epidemic days in an interview with Victor Cohn in 1975. And he said that many doctors in the 1940s were aware that the pitchmen of the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis and March of Dimes were responsible for the expanded terror that swept the nation. There were doctors that were aware of the hoax that was going on back then, and there were doctors that were writing about it, and there were doctors that were writing about what they thought polio was, but they were categorically ignored. They were thought to be quacks. Well, because the assumption was that only poliovirus could cause polio, the public believed that these pictures represented one virus only, and that a vaccine was the viable solution. The publication of these pictures was designed to make people feel what it would feel like to be like that, so that they financially supported the research and emotionally owned the resultant vaccine. This was the most dreaded complication of polio, is that you could end up on an iron lung. An iron lung was used to support respiration when the brainstem was affected or when respiratory muscles were paralyzed. This was every parent's most feared nightmare. Most people today will justify the polio vaccine with the statement, well, there are no more iron lungs today. And they're right, there are no more iron lungs today. But I'll address why there aren't any more iron lungs later. This is a graph from our book, and we have 50 color graphs that are just like this, where we gather data from all over the world, from statistical data, from as far back as records were being kept on the vaccine-targeted diseases. And this graph depicts disease incidence between 1912 and 1969 in the USA. Here we see polio at the bottom. Whoops. You can barely see it because it was a very low incidence disease, actually. But this maroon line at the bottom, we're going to look at this more closely in a minute, goes along here. And then you see in the 1950s, 1952, we have a peak. Well, polio outbreaks were first reported in the United States in 1843, but they are very small outbreaks. Right around the time that they started reporting outbreaks, there were several alterations in infant care and agriculture. In 1952, polio reached a peak in the United States with more than 21,000 cases of paralytic polio. But as we'll get into, the trick is how paralytic polio was defined. As a medical student and doctor, I never had an appreciation of the polio history between 1843 and the 1950s until I was prompted to really look into it. After today's practice, a vaccination was justified to me by referring to how polio was gone. Well, this is the maroon line extrapolated out from that previous graph and drawn out so we can see what was really going on there and track the dynamics. That 1916 spike right over here, gotta get the buttons right here. Look at that, 1916. That 1916 spike represents the largest and most devastating polio epidemic in US history. This set the blueprint for things to come. There were 23,000 cases and 5,000 deaths. That's an enormous amount of deaths. Remember, deaths are only supposed to be 5 to 10% of 1%. So what was going on here? The 25% of people that were afflicted with the disease died. Well, at the time, the epidemic was attributed to Italian immigrant children who had recently arrived in New York City. Even today, celebrity vaccine enthusiasts will inaccurately refer to the epidemic as caused by immigrants. I say inaccurately because a careful review of the immigration books revealed that this epidemic could not have been caused by those immigrants because they actually arrived after the outbreak began. Strangely, those early cases in May in Brooklyn weren't reported at the time, but they were later found at a later date by a U.S. Public Health Service researcher after the fact. Well, there's another explanation for this epidemic, and that comes from Dr. H.B. Wyatt, and he published in the Open Vaccine Journal in 2011. Dr. Wyatt has been around for a long time, and he's been writing about polio, provocation polio, and different aspects of polio since the earlier days. I don't know exactly how long, but I think since the 1950s, maybe 1960s. Well, he proposed a theory that the epidemic could have been initiated by a unique neurotropic strain of poliovirus that was being refined a few miles from the epicenter of the epidemic. At Rockefeller Lab, scientists were experimenting on a mutant poliovirus called the MV strain that had high affinity for nerve cells. The documented intention of those scientists at those labs was to produce the most virulent strain they could. That was a very curious priority, don't you think? Well, the epidemic was no regular epidemic. The case fatality rate was 25%, which is the highest ever recorded in history. Also unique to this epidemic was that it began in early May. Polio epidemics don't begin until the end of summer and early fall. So something else was going on. And like I said, this set the stage for fear. Now imagine what the country was like when this epidemic happened. People were ready to do anything they could to get rid of polio, to stomp out that darn virus. Now let's go over to the second spike in this graph. And you'll see there's a lot going on right over here. And this is what I'm going to spend most of my discussion on. The second spike involves changes in the cause, the treatment, the susceptibility factors, and the definition of polio. During the 1950s, prior to the vaccine, there was a wide net cast in order to catch everything that was called polio, and everything that could be called polio was called polio. There were also changes in breastfeeding during this period of time. There was changes in DDT use and production. Arsenic was used. Tonsillectomies were done at breakneck speed right around here. The way diseases were defined changed through here. And then there were changes in how we refined sugar and flour, which I'm going to get into in a moment. This is just an overview, so just kind of set the stage for things. The 1930s and 1940s saw an abrupt rise in formula feeding after the AMA began to endorse infant formula feeding and doctors believed it was a safe equivalent to breast milk. At the same time that infants were deprived of breast milk, we saw a rise in polio cases. Now, if we look at this graph, what we see is, I can't see it very well, but I think I remember it. So 1911, I think, is right around here in this curve. And what we see over here is time is on the y-axis, basically the years that things were started. And then over here on the x-axis, it's length of persistence of breastfeeding. And what we see is that, you know, as time went on, well, the late 1800s is when, okay, let me start from the beginning. Prior to the late 1800s, all infants were breastfed. If you didn't want to breastfeed your own infant, you hired somebody to do it. And it was a profession. Wet nursing was a profession. But at the end of the late 1800s, condensed milk was patented. And people started feeding their infants condensed milk and cow's milk and powdered milk towards the late 1800s. In the early 1900s, they started making primitive infant formulas. Well, they're all actually primitive, but these were super primitive. And so when you see the lack of breastfeeding, what's taken its place is garbage, basically. Well, if we look down where the biggest polio epidemics were happening in the 1941, I think, to 1950, that is, there was a 25% initiation rate of breastfeeding, and that the breastfeeding didn't continue for very long at all. Most people were finished around 5-6 months. Exclusively breastfed infants were exempt from polio, as noted in several epidemics. Those that had other sources of food, including cow's milk and fruit, were not exempted. And there's a reason for that. I think there's a fourfold reason. One was due to lack of maternal protection that's afforded by breast milk, which is irreplaceable. Second is due to the toxicity and inferiority of formula that can never, ever, under any circumstance, mimic breast milk, which is literally a living organism. Breast milk changes with the age of the infant. It's basically tailored to feed whatever's going on with that baby, and it can't be replaced. The third thing is that DDT in cows was coming through the cow milk, that all cows were basically treated with DDT. They were dipped in arsenic. There was all kinds of toxins going on, and this is not a secret that there was DDT in the, it may have been back then, but it isn't anymore. I can't read my own writing here. The other thing is that formula is basically an immunosuppressant. You know, when you think about how the bowel flora, how important that is, and that 70 to 80% of our immunity is there, well, when you look at an infant's bowel flora who's been fed by formula, it's a completely different constitution than what it is from a breastfed infant. No talk about vaccines, in my opinion, is complete without talking about breastfeeding. So I'm going to go on for one more slide. If you'd like to read more on the biology of breastfeeding, I highly recommend this website, beyondconformity.org.newzealand. There's enormous amounts of fascinating information, not just about breast milk, but about vaccinations. Everything is backed up with medical literature. You can click right on the links right there. You don't even have to go find the articles for yourself. It's a great site. Let's see, where am I? Breastfed infants whose mothers eat properly are endowed with everything they need to be healthy. God made everything perfect, but for some reason, humans and their science have done their best to interfere and assume that they can do better. The infant immune system is designed to be anti-inflammatory as it's learning to be in a world full of new antigens. Imagine the antigenic stimulation coming into a newborn. You don't want it to be hyperreactive. While that immunity is developing, breast milk does the work of infection control and forms a safety net in that baby. Alterations in that system come as a result of nutritional deficiencies in pregnancy, from cesarean deliveries which suppress the immune system and fail to colonize babies with good gut flora. And vaccinations have the potential to shift the immune system towards an epigenetically altered pro-inflammatory phenotype. And that's not good. When the immune system gets stimulated too early, problems come on later. Well, breast milk inactivates pathogens and it orchestrates the immune system. And I've got three references here. Breast milk, you put it in with pathogens, basically dissolves bacteria, dissolves viruses. Breast milk contains probiotics, and it also contains nutrients that make a perfect microbiome for those probiotics, not only to be dragged down through the mouth after they're swallowed at birth, but then to colonize properly the intestinal system. Breast milk also contains stem cells, and that's something that scientists found out in 2007. It's not the only place that stem cells come from. Stem cells are also found in the placenta. And there's another somewhat puzzling practice that's been going on since at least 1941, because there are papers written about it when doctors were upset watching what was happening, and that is early cord clamping. Humans are the only animals that clamp the cord before it stops pulsating. And what they do in that process, besides offer the parents for $3,000 to bank those stem cells that belong in that baby for later when it gets cancer, for a rental fee of several, I don't know, $60 per month or something like that. But what else it does besides depriving that baby of stem cells is it basically deprives that baby of a third of its blood volume that it needs, that's set back in that placenta. When a baby's being born, it's supposed to be pliable while it's going down the birth canal. It's a great system. You know, so some of its baggage gets left behind, it's born, and then it gets flushed through, the stem cells go through. Well, another puzzling thing to me is this vitamin K at birth, because if stem cells are going into an infant, you'd think you'd want the blood to be very thin so these stem cells could go where they need to go. 30% of infants are born with microhemorrhages, but the vitamin K is supposedly given to prevent hemorrhaging, but the stem cells are what's going to really go in and take care of the problem. So if you give vitamin K to a newborn infant, you're thickening their blood and those stems. First of all, if you were to give them the stem cells, they're not going to go where they want, where they need to go. The other thing is that you can really have it all. You can still wait to clamp the cord and get stem cells out of the placenta, but that's not offered to parents. There's another protein in breast milk called Hamlet, and that stands for human lactalbumin made lethal to tumor cells. So we're keep discovering new things about breast milk that scientists didn't know before. And I think we've only really hit the tip of the iceberg, but this is a fascinating protein for people who are interested in the cancer spectrum, that this protein is another element of science that defies how science was previously defined. It's a protein that can shape-shift, and it can do different, it become a food, and it can become a cancer annihilator. And you can go read about it on that link right there. It's a Swedish scientist that discovered it, and she's now been fully funded, and she's working on finding out more about that. But the bottom line is that that really belongs in the infant. But nonetheless, that protein will probably be exploited by industry before too long. The other thing about breastfed infants is that they tend to have higher IQs and neuronal connections, and I have a reference for that there, and that they have 70% lower type 1 diabetes mellitus. My last comment on this slide is that Bartik in 2011 published a paper, and his conclusion about breastfeeding was that if 90% of infants were exclusively breastfed for 6 months, every year the USA would save $13 billion and avoid 911 preventable deaths. I mean, breast milk is really amazing, and it's very protective. I want to talk about the susceptibility factor a little bit. There were native populations that were known to have harbored polioviruses of all three strains and to have no poliomyelitis whatsoever. There are several examples of this throughout the globe, but this was my favorite one. And this was a paper that was published in 1964. It's some 90-odd pages long. And this Dr. Neal went down to the Brazilian rainforest and found this Javante tribe. And they had isolated themselves from the white population for a very long time because they learned very quickly that when they interfaced, there was a lot of disease happening with them. However, they did have measles, they did have polio, they had influenza, they had salmonella, they had all the same diseases that we had, but the diseases not only weren't spreading as rapidly through their population, but they weren't dying from it, and they weren't having any poliomyelitis. When they did a random sample of blood and fecal tests on these natives, they found that they were 100% immune to all three types of poliovirus, and there was no disease whatsoever. So this makes us wonder what the added circumstances are in paralysis that we saw happening as there was continued industrialization. So I want to talk about synergy a little bit. These are added circumstances that either alone or in combination with viruses can make them more virulent. Well, synergy basically means that when two separate forces come together, that they accomplish more together than either one would have alone. Kind of like pre-existing malnutrition resulting in potentially more devastating vaccine damage, which we know is true. Well, this is the short list of synergistic entities that transformed polio from a benign inhabitant into a terrorist in a select few. The first one is injections, including antibiotics and vaccines. And this is termed provocation polio. And this isn't an occult secret concept. This is, you can Google this, you can go onto PubMed, and you can find dozens of articles about it. It was widely known that any type of intramuscular injection could precipitate poliomyelitis, but especially one with toxic chemicals and irritants. The process, the theory on the process by which this happens was as follows. I explained the pathogenesis theory of polio infection, but that when that phase when the poliovirus goes bloodborne, that there's any interruption in the tissue or breakage of the blood vessels by a needle, for instance, that poliovirus could have access into peripheral nerves and make its way into the central nervous system. Commonly, though not always, paralysis affects the injected limb when this happens. I know it's upsetting, but try not to break anything. There are numerous well-accepted reports in conventional medical literature on provocation polio that happened all over the world, and some in populations that never had clinical poliomyelitis until after the injection started. We still see this. It's still going on in India and Pakistan and places where the oral polio vaccines are being used, and there are lots of intramuscular injections. I want to talk about tonsillectomies, which is another form of provocation that that could induce another form of provocation polio. Tonsils serve as gatekeepers of lung and intestinal immunity, and this is just more evidence that God knew what he was doing here when you look at this, is that this is protection for breathing and swallowing, and there's a ring of lymphoid tissue in the throat. The top one here is the adenoid. Over on the side, we have tubal tonsils that protect the eustachian tubes. On the side, we have the palatine tonsils, which are the ones that you can see most easily when you look in this throat. Whoop. And on the bottom, we have a lingual tonsil, which you can see better over on the sagittal section. Now, which button do I want? There we go. I want to go back that way. Well, from the early 1900s right through the era of the polio epidemics, tonsillectomies became the number one bread and butter operation performed on children. Yeah, take a deep breath. By the 1950s, up to 85% of healthy, wealthy children had had the procedure. And then the procedure declined in the years that polio declined. Well, healthy tonsils were removed for a variety of financially efficient but scientifically unsound reasons. For polio virus to cause damage, it requires access to the inside of the body, which can happen through peripheral nerve damage, like we talked about with provocation from needles. Well, peripheral nerve damage is something that tonsillectomy provides in abundance. And it gives toxins and viruses direct path to the brainstem and the rest of the body, while hampering the ability of the person to entrap polio viruses in the throat and the intestinal lymphatic zones the way they're supposed to. Poliomyelitis was approximately 2 times more prevalent in tonsillectomized than non-tonsillectomized people. And during the 1930s and 1950s, bulbar poliomyelitis, these are the bulbar poliomyelitis is the one that causes brainstem problems and lack of and respiratory death. Bulbar poliomyelitis cases in tonsillectomized 1 to 10-year-olds was 6-fold higher than non-bulbar polio. Bulbar polio was 16 times as great in tonsillectomized children than it was in the general population. The recommendation at the time was to try not to do tonsillectomies during polio season. Tonsil removal also eliminates local immune globulin, meaning right in the throat production, and prevents normal antigen processing by the body. That's the first thing that throat, those lymph glands are the first thing that antigens and viruses and toxins are supposed to hit that prevents the rest of the body from becoming sick. Well, in 1971, Dr. Ogre reported in the New England Journal of Medicine that postoperatively, local polio antibody titers decreased 6- to 8-fold. The local response to the vaccine was also significantly blunted in the tonsillectomized, meaning that if you had a tonsillectomy and then you got a vaccine, you couldn't respond to it in your throat. You couldn't develop any immune globulin in your throat. There was another paper by Southcott in 1953 that suggested that removal of tonsils doesn't just increase the risk of polio for a short time, but 5 to 10 years. There were other papers that suggested it was much longer than that. After tonsillectomies, we come to white sugar. And there are two articles that I really recommend. I think there's a bibliography that you're all going to have that I listed out all these articles that I'm talking about, plus more articles. So everything I'm saying is backed up by literature that I can give you. Well, Van Meer in 1992 published a report that well-nourished victims of polio are those whose diets were rich in sugar. And the change from sporadic to epidemic polio globally coincided with local increases in the consumption of refined sugar. Chemicals, disinfectants, bleaches, and quicklime were all used in the refining process, which seems, according to Van Meer, was probably one of the reasons. Well, Dr. Benjamin Sandler wrote a little book. It's 50-some-odd pages long, and this book is also PDF'd on the internet, and you can read it. I think Whale 2 has a copy of it, too. But Dr. Sandler organized an experiment in sugar consumption starting in 1948 in North Carolina. In 1948, North Carolina had the second highest rate of poliomyelitis. So he went on radio and television and broadcast and through newspapers broadcast his theory that decreasing consumption of sugar would decrease poliomyelitis. And people were so frightened that they actually listened to him. He was surprised that people listened to him, but they did. In 1949, North Carolina saw a 90% drop in poliomyelitis cases. They went from 66.3 per 100,000 in 1948 to 6.3 in 1949. Details can be read about this in his book. His theory was basically that the postprandial hypoglycemia that happens leads cells to be susceptible to the virus. Which way do I want to go now? I already did. Okay. I love this slide. This was a Time magazine ad from 1947. Yeah, just take that in for a minute while I read to you. DDT was first synthesized in 1874, but its insecticidal properties weren't discovered until 1939. And it was used with great success in the second half of the World War II to control malaria and typhus among civilians and troops. After the war, DDT was made available for use in agricultural insecticide and for common household use. In 1962, Silent Spring was written by American biologist Rachel Carson, and this began the era of awareness of DDT's many toxicities, at least in the animal kingdom. Well, according to this, DDT could be put on your produce, you could put on the meat, you could be put near the baby, you could put it on anything you picked out in the field, the cattle. It was good for me. I'm thinking there was probably a song that went with that, but I don't know what it was. Can you hear the jingle now? If DDT was thought to be good for MEE, what doctor or what public health agency would list it as a cause for the paralysis that was ripping through the country in the 1950s? Well, there were only a few doctors at the time who were publishing to this effect, but they were ignored, like I said, and they were called quacks. This is a graph that depicts the parallel between polio epidemics in the USA and tonnage of DDT and pesticide production in the USA between 1940 and 1970. What we see is the blue line here is polio. It's magnified by 7.7, but that's basically the pattern. Look at the pattern here. And then the dotted line is DDT and other pesticide production by the ton. Polio appeared to be a vicious entity from the late 1800s until DDT was coincidentally phased out of the agricultural industries in the USA. But that didn't happen until after a vaccine for polio was well accepted as a savior for humanity in 1954. The United States was considered free of wild polio as of 1979. Insects were believed to spread polio outdoors and in the home. In response to this belief, fearful parents put DDT all through the house. They put it on drawers, they sprinkled it on windowsills, lunch boxes, directly on sandwiches, in water to rinse clothes, bedding, and mattresses, and painted it on the walls of children's rooms. You could even buy DDT impregnated wallpaper if you wanted to. It's no wonder the well-to-do had such a high problem with polio, is it? In 1951, Albert Sabin noticed that the American military in the Philippines had astonishingly high rates of polio, approximately 1 in 79 recruits. Yet he was utterly mystified as to why that would be. And he was even more mystified why the Filipino people considered polio the white man's disease at that time. He also noted similar coincidences in China and Japan. This slide is a World War II Army poster from the collection of the National Museum of Health and Medicine at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And this tells you how to de-louse an incoming recruit with DDT. What you do is you loosen all their clothes up and you get the DDT sprayer and you go down the neck, up the sleeves, down the pants, up the pants. You sit them down, you fumigate their head thoroughly, you flip their hat over and you spray it into their hat. Villages near military bases were not affected, even though in many cases local people were intermixing with the soldiers and their families. It's not very mysterious, is it? Well, DDT, refined sugar, flour, tobacco, and vaccines were all part of not only the American way of life, but the soldiers' way of life. And we know that military recruits are heavily vaccinated, often with experimental vaccines. DDT can be a sole cause of poliomyelitis, or it can be an additive factor. DDT is known to induce symptoms that can be indistinguishable from poliomyelitis, even in the absence of a virus. If there's one of my references that you read, please read this one. This is a fascinating paper. The other thing is DDT toxicity can give anterior horn and the spinal cord changes, just like polio. It can cause respiratory failure, just like polio. It causes spasm and flaccid paralysis, just like polio. Aside from that, DDT enhances the release and intracellular multiplication of polioviruses, as we see here in this paper written by Janice Gablix in 1967. And what she did is she looked at various insecticides and measured the amount of polio multiplication and release from different cells after they were treated with different insecticides. And she saw that the yield per cell of poliovirus increased 37% and 90% in the presence of DDT, depending on, trying to find my pointer here. Does anybody else see my pointer? Oh, wow, it's hiding there. It's afraid of DDT. Okay. So here we have the control, and then here we have 20 micrograms per ml, and here we have 40 micrograms per ml incubation with DDT, and the yield per cell of poliovirus nearly doubles with the 40 micrograms. There were other pesticides. One was called Kelthane, and that induced a 4 times increase in poliovirus production. And there was another one called Carathane, which induced an 18 times increase in polio production. And this is in cells. This isn't in people. This is in petri dishes. Well, what's the reason for this? I don't know for sure, but I think it's probably because DDT has a direct toxic effect upon mucosal and gut flora, and that gave polio an adaptive advantage in the digestive tract. Also, perhaps because DDT greatly depletes body stores of vitamin C, which is needed not only to process toxins, but also viruses. This is a description of DDT poisoning. Tell me if you think this sounds very different from poliomyelitis. Acute gastroenteritis with nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and diarrhea, usually associated with extreme tenesmus, runny nose, cough, and persistent sore throat, followed by persistent or recurrent feeling of constriction or lump in the throat. Now, when people present to the hospital with constriction or lump in the throat or any throat problems, they thought they were developing bulbar poliomyelitis. Occasionally, the sensation of constriction extends substernally to the back and may be associated with severe pain in either arm. Arm pain was a symptom of polio. Pain in the joints, generalized muscle weakness, which was another symptom of polio. Apprehension and exhausting fatigue are usual. The latter are often so severe in the acute stage as to be described by some patients as paralysis. How could doctors possibly have distinguished a case that looked like this from polio? They didn't. It would have been called polio and it would have been treated as such, probably with a crippling outcome. I'm going to switch over into arsenic a minute. It's going to seem like I'm backtracking a little bit. It's because I couldn't talk about arsenic and DDT at the same time, so we're going to move back to 1851, move on again. Arsenic was considered potent, effective, and safe, and to generally agree very well with children. Bartrip wrote an article in 1992, and he referenced several medical texts of the time on that. You can read it for yourself. Right about when the polio epidemics were increasing, so was the use of arsenic in household, medical, and agricultural products. Paris green and Scheele's green were dyes that were used in Paris, in Europe, and the United States. Arsenic was used to treat lung problems. Doctors would prescribe arsenic added to tobacco to be smoked. Arsenic was used to treat cholera on the basis that a greater poison would destroy a lesser poison, and this wasn't in a homeopathic remedy. This was just actual chemical arsenic. Dentists use arsenic acid to kill nerve endings in decayed teeth. Arsenic poisons moved from common household items to medicines that were approved by the AMA. In 1939, the AMA lent its seal of acceptance to a drug called triparsamide, which was an arsenic medicine manufactured by Merck under license from Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. This drug was used to counter the effect of syphilis, often with 100 injections in a single patient. I couldn't believe this when I read it. So I did a little literature search and I turned up a few papers, and this one I picked to show you. There are several quotes like this throughout this paper. It was a matter of fact thing. And they were just talking, this was a case report, said another patient who had previously received 34 injections of arsphenamine, which is another arsenic compound that was much older, 23 injections of bismuth, 76 mercury rubs, had a paretic type of serologic relapse. Can you imagine that? After 104 injections of triparsamide. This is what they called medicine in the 1930s. And we're the quacks. In 1981, a Russian doctor experimented with arsenic in various animals. Clinically, he saw poliomyelitis. At autopsy, he noted identical pathological changes as poliomyelitis. Dr. Papau concluded that arsenic, even a few hours after its ingestion, may cause acute central myelitis or acute poliomyelitis. This is another amazing article, The Poison Cause of Poliomyelitis and Obstructions to Its Investigation. This is a must read. This was actually used to testify in front of the House of Representatives. They still didn't listen. Cows and other farm animals exhibited identical symptoms to humans in the early 1900s and 1930s. but cows are not susceptible to poliovirus. Some families called what their children had the cow disease. Cows were dipped in, on all kinds of livestock, were dipped in arsenic water in order to get rid of bugs. Sister Elizabeth Kenny was an Australian nurse who started treating infantile paralysis in the outback, and she just did whatever she could do at the time. And she wrote an autobiography, and innocently in her autobiography, she knew nothing about what was causing polio or the poison cause. But she said that a very agitated father of seven came to me with the appalling announcement that his 10-year-old son and his 4-year-old daughter had been taken with what he called the cow disease, and neither of them could stand or walk. They went lame yesterday, just like the cattle have been doing for the past 2 or 3 weeks, he explained, and today they can't move. But this was called infantile paralysis, and it was all lumped in the same basket as polio. So that's what polio was, and now we're going to talk about where polio went. Sister Elizabeth Kenny was a nurse who started in the Australian outback in the early 1900s. She was self-educated in the beginning and probably a mechanical genius, but mind you that most doctors back then didn't go to medical school. They were apprenticed. So she was really no different than they were, so don't hold that against her. She had a weakling brother, and she wanted to help him. So she wrote to a local doctor in town, and he sent her some physiology texts, and she studied them. And she not only rehabilitated her brother from being a weakling who couldn't get into the military, but he ended up being the strongest man in his military barracks. And there's a picture of him that you would never believe anybody would call him a weakling. I don't have that picture. But basically, she continued to hone her techniques during World War I, where she served as a nurse on these dark missions that went from Australia to where the war was going on. And there were lots of paralyzed soldiers, and she kept working on their paralysis. Some of it was intuitive, and some of it was using her physiology knowledge that she picked up over the years. So she developed a method that was called muscle reeducation, and later on she published several books on this. She started treating poliomyelitis in the Australian countryside because nobody else knew what to do about it, so she just did what she could, and she developed techniques that involved using hot packs on the muscles and never immobilization like the orthopedists were doing. Well, her success was known far and wide after a while, and she was invited to demonstrate her techniques in front of the orthopedists, and she basically humiliated them. And she was still only allowed to treat their failures. She wasn't allowed to treat fresh poliomyelitis patients. She was only allowed to treat the failures of those doctors when they couldn't do anything else after they had immobilized them for 6 months to 2 years and done tendon transplantations and things like that. Then they gave them over to her. Well, they wanted her to go away real bad because she was really humiliating them. But the fact that she became known far and wide by word of mouth led parents to choose her as the option 80% of the time when they were given the option. They chose her over the orthopedists. She was so famous in the 1930s, 1940s, that there was a major motion picture about her that starred Rosalind Russell. It was a very successful motion picture. It opened in Times Square, and on opening night, 20,000 people stormed through Times Square, broke the barricades just to get close to Sister Kenny and to see the film. Now, the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis and the AMA hated Sister Kenny. They pretended to invite her over and treat her well, and they said that they would give her grant money and help her train people. But what ended up happening is that they undermined her. And they did training programs, but they didn't listen to what she said. She said it was a minimum of 2 years to train people, and they were often graduating people in a matter of 2 weeks because they didn't want her to be successful. That's what I think. This is my opinion. Because she was basically changing the way polio looked. You know, people would come into the hospital, and while an orthopedist would put them on an iron lung, Sister Kenny would sit there with them and do her technique, and they wouldn't need an iron lung. They were putting people in plaster casts, and she was doing hot packs and her form of physical therapy, and they were fully rehabilitated very, very quickly. Well, the reason Sister Kenny's an important figure in polio has to do with the change of treatment that decreased the number of deformed and contracted limbs where her method was used, which wasn't everywhere. But she did travel all around the world. She went to Paris. She went to Warsaw. She spent time in London and set up clinics there. How the stiff, painful, numb muscles were handled had a lot to do with the face of polio. Splinting and casting paralyzed limbs was the primary form of treatment. Limbs were immobilized and cast for 3 to 6 months and often as long as 2 years by the orthopedists. Many of the polio patients who would have otherwise recovered were hindered by over-immobilization, which led to dysfunction of limbs, whether they were diseased or not. This is another quote from Dr. John Paul given to Victor Cohn during that interview. And he said, "Before she came, if you could have visited the hospital, you would have seen little kids lying stiff and rigid, crying with pain, even though, as she saw, they were not necessarily paralyzed. We take the children to the operating room in those days, straighten them out under anesthetic, and put them in plaster casts. When they woke up, they screamed. The next day, they still cried from the pain. That was the accepted and universal treatment virtually all over the world. I saw it in Boston and New York City and London." And she said, "That's all wrong." What she did was the complete opposite of that. The way she saw polio was the complete opposite of how the orthopedists saw it. They saw it as there was a paralyzed muscle and that the strong muscle was causing the deformity. She saw that the deformity was caused by spasm. She treated the spasm and she had great results. But they didn't like being told that they were wrong. The conventional plan by orthopedists was early and prolonged splinting, surgical straightening, and then multiple surgeries and interventions, including tendon cutting, tendon transplantation, and any other creative salvage operations the orthopedist wanted to do, and also included painful and ineffective electrical treatments. Sister Kenny often took their failures and turned them around in a matter of days to weeks. There were some cases where she would go to a hospital and they would bring in a polio patient, and she would, in a matter of minutes, be able to straighten out a limb or a scoliosis in front of the orthopedic doctors. Well, she finally was able to start treating fresh cases, and they almost never needed iron lungs under her treatment, and they had much better recovery rates. The thing about Sister Kenny is that she produced functional citizens. You know, they were terribly deformed people that the orthopedist had given her, but she was able to get them out of the hospital, get them working again, get them having children and being able to raise their own children, and that's what made the difference between her and them. Now we're going to talk about another branch of what made polio go away. Prior to 1954, there was an extremely wide diagnostic net cast, which put everything under one name, poliomyelitis. Dr. Bernard Greenberg was the head of a department of biostatistics at the University of North Carolina School of Public Health and chairman of the Committee on Evaluation and Standards of the American Public Health Association. And in 1960, he reflected and he said that prior to 1954, physicians reported polio to subsidize the cost of hospitalization and report communicable diseases. It was a community service back then that for doctors to report polio. They were highly on the lookout for it. And when they reported it, they could get services for these people and they could, you know, report a supposedly communicable disease. Well, the criterion for diagnosing polio included just two examinations 24 hours apart showing one muscle group being paralyzed. That was all that was required to diagnose polio prior to 1954. Laboratory confirmation and presence of residual paralysis wasn't required. Before the vaccine, health professionals were vigilantly programmed to be on the lookout for polio. After the vaccine trials in 1954, they were originally noting who developed polio, whether they were vaccinated or unvaccinated, and then they made every effort to diagnose a non-polio illness in a vaccinated person. In 1955, it became obvious that there were problems with the contents of that very wide net that was being cast to be called polio, particularly as paralytic cases were increasing after Jonas Salk's vaccines were started and not decreasing as they had hoped they would. Well, the first move to align the embarrassing medical data with acceptable progress from the vaccines was to change the criteria relating to the difference between paralytic and non-paralytic polio. And this was done with the sweep of a pen. In 1954 was the year that Salk's vaccine was licensed and marketed in 2 hours. 2 hours of deliberation is all it took. It's the fastest tracking of a medication in history. The new diagnostic criteria required two exams 60 days apart to have paralysis. Now, most of those cases that were 24 hours examinations, they were going to resolve. So just by virtue of making this change, he said accurately that the change in 1955 meant that we were reporting a new disease, namely paralytic poliomyelitis with a longer lasting paralysis. And just by virtue of that, polio was bound to decline. Well, paralysis had actually increased 50% between 1957 and 1958, and 80% between 1958 and 1959. He said that the new definitions that they had helped to hide that. He concluded that the U.S. health officials had manipulated the statistics to give entirely the opposite impression of what was happening. In need to talk about Jonas Salk's vaccine a little bit. This is, I have a lot of this in my book, and I'm just going to tell you the bare minimum right now. But Jonas Salk's vaccine design had an inherent flaw. And the powers that were in the 1950s would not listen to a specific Swedish virology expert named Dr. Sven Gard when he tried to tell them that the formaldehyde he was putting in that vaccine was not going to kill all the viruses by the method that he was using. But they wouldn't listen. The truth is that the viruses in Salk's vaccines were impossible to completely inactivate with the formaldehyde method. No vaccine manufacturer could do it, especially after the mercury compound that was used in 1954 for the field trials was removed after licensure in 1955. There were reports of vaccines passing all the safety tests by the manufacturers, only to be retested from the bottles 3 months later and finding abundant live virus in them. Well, there was a big vaccine mishap in 1955 called the Cutter incident, and that had everybody very nervous. The reputation of the vaccine was threatened by the public learning that at least 220,000 people were infected with live vaccine poliovirus of a most virulent strain. 70,000 developed muscle weakness, 164 were severely paralyzed, and 10 were killed. An estimated 40,000 cases of abortive polio occurred. Now know that any live virus that was in those vaccines injected into people could have then been spread far and wide in the community, whether that person got sick or not. The excuse they gave for this problem was that they said that the monkey kidney cells that they used to incubate the virus and are inevitably brought into the vaccine clumped together, and that the vaccine, that the virus particles were at the center of those monkey kidney cells couldn't be reached by the formaldehyde. But that's really not what happened. What really happened was that formaldehyde inactivation process was flawed from the start. And the Swedish scientists knew it, and the National Foundation scientists, if they argued about it, like I said, they got fired. Well, in order to make the vaccine safer, because they knew they couldn't kill the viruses properly, they essentially watered it down 10 minutes? Whoa. This isn't going to happen. Now I have to be really selective. They watered it down with filtration after extra filtration. And when that didn't work, they moved to license over to the Sabin vaccines, and they abandoned Jonas Salk's vaccine altogether. Well, think about this. Why was it that children were asked to line up for the Salk vaccines between 1955 and 1959, and then from 1962 onwards, those same children were told again that they needed to line up for 3 doses of the Sabin vaccine as well? Well, you might think it's just because the Salk vaccine didn't work so well, and that's true, but there's more to the story. The truth is that the Salk vaccine of the 1950s that was credited as saving the children was either live, and if you survived it, you essentially survived an injected case of poliovirus. Fortunately, 80 to 90% of children at the time carried antibody to at least one strain of poliovirus, which meant that fortunately, they were also immune to the vaccine. Or it was so watered down that it didn't stimulate any immunity whatsoever. But either way, the Department of Health and Human Services and the Polio Surveillance Unit were unwilling to publicly admit that there was a serious problem with the Salk vaccine. So it was easiest to just revaccinate everyone, and almost everyone complied. Well, since that time, the population has become used to complying with constant changing vaccination protocols, so that parents today don't think about the fact that they're advised to have pertussis vaccine in every pregnancy, and everyone around the baby is supposed to be vaccinated in order to supposedly cocoon that baby. How many whooping cough shots did you get when you were a child? Now we're in a situation where whooping cough vaccines are pretty much a regular event, cradle to grave. And the incidence of clinical whooping cough today in the most heavily vaccinated populations ever is higher than it used to be. Well, the polio vaccine set the stage for open-ended vaccine policies, and it conditioned parents to not question vaccination. What would parents have thought and done if they had known the truth about polio? Things would be very different today. Well, this officially sanctioned history is why today's experts are obeyed when they recommend revaccinating everyone with pertussis and flu vaccines, even when it's obvious from the medical literature that a person's susceptibility to a pathogen isn't determined by the pathogen, but by the host.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a nice day.